or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to this week's episode of Information Week Live. This is Information Week Live for the week of May 15th, 2016, and I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Technology Content at Information Week. Well, we've got a great show this week, a lot to cover because it has been a very, very busy week out in the industry. And I'm going to be joined today by my fellow editor from Information Week editor at large, Charlie Babcock. Charlie, welcome to Information Week Live.
Greetings, Kurt, and thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you with us here, and we're going to dive in. This week, I know I was busy gathering information out at SAP's largest worldwide conference. They call it Sapphire Now. It has just concluded in Orlando, Florida, and it was a big deal. They said that it was the biggest Sapphire Now ever. They announced over 35,000 attendees and said that another 35 to 40,000 were watching the proceedings online. And I'll tell you, Charlie, it was interesting because the folks at SAP were using words that most of us wouldn't associate with an enterprise software company like SAP. One of those words was open. They talked an awful lot about open things this week at SAP Sapphire. And the other, interestingly enough, was beauty. And that was often in connection with the Apple partnership that they announced. I've got to ask, Charlie, you've been around the industry about as long as I have. Do you often hear enterprise software companies use words like beautiful to describe their applications?
You know, I think everybody's now trying to do their best Steve Jobs imitation since he isn't around to criticize them. He used the word, we make beautiful products. It was a notion that technologists had shied away from from the beginning of compute history. The one thing they did not do was make beautiful products that would sound like they were elegant designers, not good technicians. So no, it's maybe going to be trafficked more heavily now, but SAP somehow shows remarkable staying power. I consider them a kind of previous generation software company, except they are much alive and well in this generation. Where even Oracle may be struggling, SAP seems to chug along. Enterprise resource planning and management unimpeded. They fit into the cloud era, and that was what I was struck by this week, that both Microsoft and Amazon had cloud announcements concerning SAP.
Yeah, it was fascinating because, of course, Microsoft's chairman and CEO was there at Sapphire to talk about the HANA on Azure. We've got HANA running all kinds of places. And to me, the fascinating thing is they talk about HANA on Azure, HANA on the SAP HANA Enterprise Cloud, or HEC, as they like to talk about it in the world of SAP. But on the show floor there at Sapphire, there were still an awful lot of companies doing demos with an instance of HANA running on a laptop. And I know that even SAP themselves in previous years have done things like had demonstrations of HANA running on a Mac Mini. So this is really a fascinating architecture because they want it to be used for some of the very large data sets out there, but they're also very proud of the fact that it can run in a very small footprint. And that's also just a little unusual among the enterprise software crowd.
Sure, sure. And I would say they go from one extreme to the other. Amazon announced a new cloud instance specifically for running HANA. And it's the opposite of a laptop. It's a big honking for CPU, for physical CPU, 128 virtual CPUs, server, virtual server for HANA, and it includes 2 terabytes of memory. And so as Microsoft talks up HANA on Azure, AWS talks about the biggest virtual server available for running HANA at the same time. That's pretty good, HANA coverage as far as SAP must be concerned.
Yeah, and, one of the fascinating things to watch at this year's Sapphire was the extent to which HANA was being discussed as a way to do big data analytics. There was an awful lot of talk about using HANA as the analytics component for a Hadoop deployment, for example, and the extent to which HANA can incorporate and work with Spark. And all of the various bits and pieces, there was a great deal of discussion around how HANA and the various SAP components can be thought of as containers from the virtual software standpoint. And in one of the better questions, and it brought an SAP executive up short. One of the journalists asked if they'd ever thought about open sourcing HANA. And the answer was, we think about a lot of things. So you get the sense that at least for the time being, is a bridge too far for SAP. But they certainly are doing their best to make HANA compatible with and friendly to an awful lot of open source components. And, Charlie, I respect you because you keep your eye on so many different parts of the open source world. When you talk to open source people, are they crying out for these proprietary tools like HANA to bring additional functionality, or do most open source folks really want everything in the entire stack to be open source?
Well, no, they're not crying out for the proprietary stuff to become open source. They are impressed with their own work and with what can be done with the existing open source tools. But among the proprietary software systems, a couple really big success stories these days are IBM Watson and SAP HANA. And you have to note where the industry is headed. You need a general purpose analytical system that can be given many different tasks, do many different things. It will serve a lot of specific purposes, but the underlying system has a kind of general purpose capability, and somehow IBM once again and SAP seem to have the legs there to keep running while other people are falling by the wayside. Very good open source options available, and in many cases HANA is looking to work with open source. I'm not going to hold my breath on HANA becoming open source. I think it's just too valuable to SAP at this point and far into the future, nor does SAP have a particularly impressive track record in terms of making things open source. I just wouldn't hold my breath.
No, as I said, I think that's probably farther than the board is going to be willing to go. It is always amazing for those who know anything about SAP. The charismatic leader of SAP is a gentleman named Hasso Plattner, who was one of the original founders of SAP back in the early 1970s. He and a group of other engineers left IBM to form SAP, and Hasso is now the chairman of the executive board, which is one of those positions that is influential, but not involved in day-to-day management. So definitely he has stepped down about many years ago as the CEO. It's fascinating to hear him give his traditional final day keynote, because he is passionate about HANA. It really is largely his brainchild, his basic design. And I think there is a part of him that would love to see HANA open source, because it would increase the number of people who would use it. And I think Hasso would love to see every company in the world making some use of HANA. But then again, according to Forbes, he has somewhere over $9 billion worth of SAP stock. So the other part of him is probably entirely happy to keep folks paying subscription fees for HANA's capabilities. But, you know,
I didn't realize it was his brainchild. That's an interesting tidbit. And yes, maybe he would have some push toward open source. That's sort of interesting. But in general, name the big pieces of open source code that have come out of the German software companies. I'm thinking of all the failed companies that had the best technology for their time and then fell by the wayside because things changed so fast.
Yeah, as you say, for various reasons, there is a lot of cultural and historical baggage that would have to be overcome if something like that were to ever happen. So I think that is probably going to stay in the realm of interesting fan fiction for the time being. But there was still an awful lot coming out of Sapphire. But Sapphire wasn't the only thing. I wanted to ask. I've been freezing to death in the highly air-conditioned confines of the Orange County Convention Center there in Orlando. And I was going to ask you, what else has been going on out in the world of technology? What were you taking a look at this week?
Well, I was sort of interested in Hewlett-Packard Enterprise trying to come up with an Internet of Things platform. They have a good reputation for being vendor neutral, and there's no area that needs a little neutrality more than the Internet of Things. So HP has come up with a way to build applications and connect those applications to different sorts of device networks. There's a lot of competing standards. HP will cut across two or three of them and provide platform connectivity. So that, you know, the Internet of Things has not lived up to its potential yet, but when you look at a company like HP, which began kind of in the small test and measurement device, always respectful of standards, trying to stay neutral in a contentious marketplace, suddenly I think of HP as having a new arena in which its culture may play itself out rather well.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about HP, because there was someone at Sapphire talking about HP. Steve Wozniak was one of the keynote speakers on the first afternoon of the show, and he talked about how he had seen HP as a company when he was a very young engineer before they started Apple, and how his original plan was to try and get a job at HP and just do Apple as a hobby. But that didn't work out because, frankly, HP wouldn't give him a job. So, the rest, as they say, is history. But the Internet of Things is one of those incredibly fascinating topics. Another one of those I was hearing a lot about in a somewhat different context, because the folks at Sapphire were talking about the industrial Internet of Things, which seems to be actually progressing more quickly than the consumer Internet of Things, because there's real hard dollars attached to doing analysis and control based on sticking sensors all over processes and all over things like rolling stock for a company, so that the systems can get into things like predictive maintenance. So it's almost like listening to two entirely different technology stories when you hear consumer IoT people talking versus all the people talking about industrial IoT. And I think it's fascinating that that HP is looking at the consumer side and trying to bring some value there.
And it's probably looking at the industrial side too. If anything, it may figure out some ways to allow enterprises to participate in the Internet of Things or become active on the Internet of Things themselves. GE, of course, is a real thought leader in this area and uses the example of its jet engines as a type of investment that can be translated from a physical product into a number of service hours guaranteed by all the sensors and feedback it collects on the jet engine as it's used. That's very forward-thinking, and I think everyone will move in this direction, including auto manufacturers, et cetera, guaranteeing the lifespan of the product because you're going to be servicing it before it breaks down. That's the theory, at least. And I wanted to talk about that with the Vice President of Research at GE. I have an appointment with him next week. Colin Paris is coming to San Francisco, and there's an event where all of this will be a topic of conversation. And unfortunately, I've been called to jury duty. I'm going to have to cancel that appointment and fall behind my GE update, which I had been looking forward to.
Oh, I hate to hear that, because I was getting all excited about your GE update as well. Here's hoping for a plea bargain early in the week that might spring you early enough to let you go ahead. And I know in previous years I've talked to folks. They're always fascinating people to talk to there at GE, because they really do a lot of truly fascinating things at that company.
Yeah, and they are out front. They have a habit of advanced thinking. So, yes, it would be good to talk to them, and I'll be trying to catch up. I'm gonna go with your plea bargain concept there. I like that. I'll let them know when I arrive at the courthouse that's in order.
Charlie, one of the things that I would love to get your take on, because it's true of the Internet of Things, whether we're talking about consumer side or industrial side, in order to really do anything to make the Internet of Things work, you've got to do some analysis on the information that's being returned. And no matter which side you're looking at, you're talking about vast quantities of information that's coming in at an awfully fast pace. You were talking about HP, and they're looking at the Internet of Things with the different open source and other projects that you talk to people about. Do you hear many people out in the community talking about dealing with these huge data flows, these huge transaction numbers and how they need to adapt the technology to deal with that? Or is that something that everyone is sort of hoping someone else will figure out?
You know, we're not quite there yet, and I think it's almost the latter, that there will be a vast community of independent programmers who grow up around the Internet of Things, creating applications that deal with all the data in a lot of specific ways. HPE will offer its Vertica system, column-oriented database for analyzing the data that comes in to its planned storage for the Internet of Things. It also has Haven on Demand, which is a set of APIs that would give you access to machine learning, like small machine learning applications for different purposes. And that strikes me as artful HP approach. Don't force every developer to come up with the analytics by themselves. Give them analytics tools and let them go to work. But so far, other than GE and jet engines and the other things that it makes, the big companies are not into building small analytic applications for the Internet of Things. That may look a little more like the iPhone market, where thousands of developers build small apps for millions of consumers.
Well, you know, I was talking to people, and one of the things that SAP has started doing, and I'll have an article in the next few days detailing some of this, is put a small instance of a database out on the perimeter. So, you know, essentially put the hardware and software to make a lot of decisions, rough cut decisions, out on the perimeter, then stream data back to the big analytics engine. And one of the things that is fascinating to me, they assume that much of the Internet of Things data is going to get dumped into a Hadoop-based data lake. And they recognize the latency that comes when you start moving data around in order to do analysis on it. So they've got some techniques where they basically do what they're called streaming data, where they try to apply analytics and decision rules to the data on the fly. So they don't require stuffing it into a HANA instance, then pulling it out to do analysis on it. But as it's being moved from place to place, just go ahead and do the analytics. It gets complicated, but you know they're looking at ways to deal with these highly transactional data streams, and it's definitely a work in progress, even for people who are used to dealing with some awfully big data flows.
Yeah, that all sounds like a kind of a cloud principle where you scale out rather than scale up, and I would call it distributed analytics. You could do a phase of analytics that vastly reduces the data stream, saves it at a particular gateway close to the source, does analytics on it, which reduces the amount of data that needs to go forward to the next gateway. And you could keep hopping up the food chain, the analytical food chain, until, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of devices' data is being summarized and forwarded. And the amount of data that keeps moving toward the central repository remains roughly the same. It's just been summarized again and again. And if you need to find out why some aberrations are occurring, where they're occurring, what all the data is behind them, you would reverse the process and go back down the food chain until you came to the point where that aberration originated and all the data was still there that would explain it. And this notion of distributed analytics, I think, will catch on. It's the only way to kind of live with the huge amounts of data that can be generated. The idea that we're going to store all of the Internet of Things data in one big repository somewhere, possibly in Washington, D.C., is ridiculous. We can't do that, and we'll find ways to apply distributed principles that have worked so well in the cloud to supply compute cycles and storage volumes. We'll start applying that to analytics and distribute the share the workload outward, scaling out from a central repository.
Now, Charlie, I've got to say I think you're being silly, this notion of the Internet of Things data being stored in Washington, D.C. Everyone knows that IoT data is being stored in a repository in the desert in Utah. So, you know, that's just...
yes, possibly in Roswell.
Yes, anyway. Let's be sure to keep our paranoid fantasies straight. It's very important that we all do that. Well, you know, we're coming down toward the end of our time on this particular show, and I've got other things that I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to be following up my time at Sapphire. This is one of those shows where I spend 3 days just having meeting after meeting after meeting, and then it takes me a little while to digest it all, including things like I would not have dreamed prior to this week that my first encounter with wearing an Oculus Rift virtual reality headset would be at an SAP gathering. But sure enough, they were showing demos of virtual reality interfaces because they know that essentially your basic tabular view isn't sufficient to let people deal with the vast quantities of data now available, even after those quantities of data have been analyzed. So they have scientists looking at different ways of doing visual interface, just all kinds of interesting stuff going on. Lots of stuff we're going to be talking about. And, we're roaring into the beginning of summer with the Memorial Day weekend. So, Charlie, let me ask, what do you have your eye on for the coming week? What should we be looking for coming off of your keyboard in the week to come?
Well, I'm taking a look at how a chip producer, XR, whose products begin with the letters XR followed by a number. They're used, they're signal processing chips and used in many consumer devices and parts of the manufacturing and other parts of the infrastructure. They've moved their Oracle system from on-premises into the AWS cloud. We'll be taking a look at that. And then we'll be looking at the opposite direction of how Dropbox moved off the AWS cloud. So I guess we're going to be bi-directional next week, if not bi-coastal and other bi things, and look at those two things. But, Kurt, I wanted to ask you, weren't you thunderstruck by the fact that LinkedIn may have lost not may have, but did lose the passwords to 117 million accounts? I'm dumbstruck that I believe something had happened once before, and now a really major hack has occurred.
Yeah, they had a major release that wasn't made public for a while, but I believe back in 2012, they had a huge exploit, and this one really is amazing. You look at a company like LinkedIn, one that prides itself on being a professional organization. You would think that they would pay special attention to the basic credentials, especially because so many other software platforms allow people to use LinkedIn as their authentication credentials.
Right.
So this is one of those cases similar to, you know, if Facebook were to lose 100 million plus passwords, it's not just the impact on LinkedIn in this case. It's the impact on all of those other services that use LinkedIn as their authentication. You know, this is the downside to the whole federated identity notion. On the one hand, it makes life much easier for the users. On the other hand, it raises the stakes considerably when there is a breach of security. So I think it's going to be fascinating. I will say that there's a whole community of users out there where between Target and the Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and some of the others, there are people who should never have to pay for identity protection again. With all of the one-year identity protection that they're getting free based on all of these breaches, there are people who will have their identity protected until they retire and go to live off the grid. But that is searching desperately for a silver lining to apply to what is a very dark cloud indeed.
Yes. Some of us are going to need a device to carry all of our changed passwords on, or to remember our passwords as we change them every 30 days. I think this is a very serious breach, and the fact that it does cut across the different social network media and is going to leave a lot of people very dissatisfied.
Well, we'll see if perhaps by next Friday we can get someone like our colleague Sarah Peters to come over from Dark Reading and drop in, give us a lot more detail and scare the living daylights out of us concerning what's behind all this.
Good idea.
Well, Charlie, real quickly, speaking of social networks, I know that you are active on social media. How can people follow you and keep up with what all the different things that you're doing?
Well, I tweet at Babcock CW. That's the main way to try to keep up, I think.
We will do that. Tell all our listeners, if you're not following Charlie, you really need to. He is one of the people who is an expert in so many different fields and always does a great job of making top-level journalism happen around the enterprise world. We appreciate it. Charlie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Kurt. Take care.
As for me, as I mentioned, I'm going to be wrapping up more stuff from Sapphire. We'll also be getting ready to launch into the summer. I've got some CIO interviews coming up early next week. We should have another book list. And here's something I'm going to put to the listeners. A number of people over the years have suggested something that amounts to an online book club for executives here at Information Week. Is that something you would be interested in? Let me know. Drop an email to me at curtis.franklin@ubm.com or send me a direct message on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. That's the same name I use on Instagram and on Periscope. If you want, feel free to look me up on LinkedIn. And I want to remind you that Information Week has a community group on LinkedIn. So if you're on LinkedIn and would like to keep up with what we're doing there, go to the Information Week group page, ask to join. I promise it'll happen quickly. And we're going to be doing some interesting new things over there, trying out some different media types, trying out some different ways of telling stories. So we would love to have you as part of that community, love to get your feedback. Well, we appreciate you spending time with us. If you're listening to this in a streaming or podcast version, I want to remind you that we broadcast live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, and there is a live text chat that goes along with each episode. We'd love to have you listening live and have your voice in that online conversation. Well, until next week, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next time.